morning. It's 7 a.m. and it's 54 degrees this morning, Tuesday, September 15th. The high will rise today to 69. And you're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York. Coming up next, A New Day. On the show, we'll speak to Jose Saldana, director of Release Aging People in Prison, RAP, and Eva Diaz, whose son was beaten to death by guards in a Philadelphia detention center. We'll get an update on conditions in prisons as the pandemic continues to spread, with very little attention given to its effects behind prison walls. We'll also hear about current organizing efforts to support prisoners and the fight for decarceration, as well as the widespread brutality inflicted in prisons by prison guards. Stay tuned for headlines. This is your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. At least 399 new coronavirus deaths and 339 new cases were reported in the United States as of September 13th. Over the past week, there have been an average of over 35,000 new cases per day, a decrease of 17% from the average 2 weeks earlier. As of Monday afternoon, more than 6.5 million people in the United States have been infected with the coronavirus, and at least 194,200 people have died here in the United States, according to the New York Times database. And scientists say an enormous chunk of Greenland's ice cap, estimated to be about 42.3 square miles, has broken off in the far northeastern Arctic. They see it as evidence of rapid climate change, which is leading to the disintegration of the Arctic's largest remaining ice shelf. One scientist says, "We should be very concerned about the ice loss." In August, a study showed that Greenland lost a record amount of ice during an extra warm 2019. Meanwhile, Donald Trump on Monday ignored the consensus that climate change is playing a role in California as wildfires continue to roar up and down the West Coast. Trump reiterated his unfounded claim that poor forest management is to blame for the fires. And since March of this year, the Trump administration has deported nearly 9,000 unaccompanied migrant children from the United States without a court hearing, taking no precautions to protect these children from human traffickers. The Center for Disease Control has authorized these deportations, citing the spread of disease by migrants. But this is a pretext and reflects the dangerous politicization of the CDC. The Trump administration has weaponized an arcane provision of a quarantine law first enacted in 1893 and revised in 1944. The law was used to quarantine people with diseases coming into the country. But Trump has been using the arcane law since March to order the blanket deportation of asylum seekers and unaccompanied minors at the Mexican border without any testing or finding of disease or contagion. The Trump administration is using this 1944 law to sidestep children's legal rights to hearings, appeals, asylum screening, and child-specific procedures and protections. Further, the Trump administration is callously misapplying the law for a racist purpose. When that law was first enacted, Congress rejected calls for targeting immigrants for deportation with that law. It recognized that any traveler, regardless of citizenship, could arrive here in the United States carrying a communicable disease, and that any law addressing that concern should apply equally to all, not specifically to migrants. And critically, since that law was updated in 1944, Congress has enacted landmark refugee and child protection laws that the administration is now evading. You're tuned to listener sponsor WBAI New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, host of A New Day. And on Monday, A New Day reported on Michael Caputo, the Assistant Secretary of Health for Public Affairs in the Trump administration. He has been attempting to warp the CDC data on coronavirus to fit Trump's political agenda. Yesterday, he told a Facebook audience without evidence that left-wing hit squads were being trained for insurrection, and he accused CDC scientists of, quote, sedition. On his 26-minute speech on Facebook, he said, quote, there are scientists who work for this government who do not want America to get well, not until after Joe Biden is president, unquote. He said also that he could personally be in danger. He went on to say, quote, you understand that they're going to have to kill me, and unfortunately, I think that's where this is going, unquote. Stoking public anxiety about the election, like Trump, Caputo has suggested that the election will not be fairly decided. He says, quote, if you carry guns, buy ammunition, ladies and gentlemen, because it's going to be hard to get. This is what he urged followers. And he's predicting that Biden will not concede to a Trump victory. Quote, and when Donald Trump refuses to stand down at the inauguration, the shooting will begin. The drills that you've seen are nothing. Unquote. So this is the person who's been appointed to the CDC to direct the show, Michael Caputo, who is saying this, these incendiary comments in public on Facebook, and essentially adding to the insanity that will grip, that is likely to grip American society in the run-up to November. And when I read this, I literally thought racism done turned some white folks crazy. in a very dangerous way, because he's literally inciting white militias to buy ammunition and guns and to engage in shootouts in the streets come election time. And this is a related story. Last week on Friday, an anti-mask rally took place in St. George, Utah. And the story is related because it speaks to the utter abandonment of reason and science on the part of large sections of the American population. Trump has a support record of 40% of American society. That's a huge percentage of this society that's paying attention to people whose rationale, propaganda, rhetoric, comments, speeches are utterly unhinged. And so this is a continuation of that. And if you've got a Caputo in office who's spouting these insane statements, it's going to trickle down to the rank and file support of the Trump administration. In any case, here's what's happening in Utah, or happened in Utah last Friday. Thousands showed up expressing that being forced to put masks on their children is illegal and unconstitutional. Clips from the protest are going viral because they sound literally like a sketch from Saturday Night Live. Let's listen.
No more masks! No more masks!
Not on the backs of my kids, or you're going to get more federal funding. That's how I feel about that.
A passionate call for action Friday morning in St. George. Several police officers on standby, as many locals called concerns about coronavirus spikes overblown.
The flu kills more than coronavirus.
Others calling the virus a hoax, or stating that asymptomatic carriers simply do not exist and they cannot be forced to wear masks anywhere as citizens of the United States.
If we want to wear a mask, that's fine. We can take care of ourselves.
Some rally attendees say they shouldn't ever wear masks if they have any medical issues or mental health concerns, or if they feel they simply can't breathe.
When George Floyd was saying, "I can't breathe," and then he died, and now we're wearing a mask, and we say, "I can't breathe," but we're being forced to wear it anyway.
But many stated that they believe in all cases, masks jeopardize kids' health. Parents are demanding they have the right to decide what to do with their children.
I'll tell you another reason I'd hate masks. Most child molesters love them.
School administrators responding that they don't understand why crowds are protesting them based on a mandate given by the governor.
They blocked off the front entrance to the school building, and we went out to ask them to move, and they attempted to storm the school building.
The school board is implementing the governor's recent order that face shields alone are not enough. And if a parent is adamant that their child cannot wear a mask or a shield, they must fill out a form including a doctor's note so the district can review it.
And that was a report of the anti-mask protest in St. George from Friday morning. And these issues are important at this moment, the issue of children wearing masks as schools open across the country. And it's 7:13. You're tuned to listener sponsor WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree with a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good.
times, and I get more than my share. But that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you. Oh, oh, baby, I'm just human. Don't you know I have faults like anyone? Sometimes I find myself alone regretting some little foolish thing, some simple thing that I've done. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.
And that was Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood by Nina Simone. I'm sure you've heard the statistic many times, including on this program, that the United States has about 4% of the world's population, but 25% of deaths from COVID-19. And that statistic, as you might know, mirrors another very important statistic, that the United States has about 4% of the world's population and about 25% of the world's prisoners. From the moment the pandemic began, there were calls on governors to take strong action to decarcerate, from supporters of prisoners' rights as well as public health advocates. The need for decarceration was obvious for a number of reasons, from the prison's complete inability to provide adequate medical care to the near guarantee of many prisons acting as super spreaders due to tight living conditions, poor air quality, and the high percentage of prisoners who are elderly, immunocompromised, or both. Well, governors, by and large, have not taken the necessary action to decarcerate. And what has happened is exactly what advocates feared. Prison administrators have responded to high numbers of COVID cases with inaction, denial, and horribly insufficient medical care, resulting in many deaths that could have been prevented. What we are seeing are the consequences of a system that prioritizes punishment and shows little to no regard for the humanity of people who have been criminalized. And outbreaks are still happening, even as media attention around outbreaks in prisons have waned. Just last week, there were 4 new outbreaks of COVID-19 in Pennsylvania prisons and jails, according to the Pennsylvania Prison Society. Here is a letter written by someone who is currently incarcerated. It was recorded by their friend, describing the condition in the prisons right now. Let's take a listen.
Asthma and upper respiratory complications in the past. Currently, if we go to medical for COVID symptoms, we're denied testing if we don't have a fever, and it gets brushed off as a common cold without even being tested. This facility does not practice social distancing and has never implemented any testing, so it's difficult to determine who's positive. I just want to make it home to my family safe. As time goes on, more and more correctional officers are working the blocks without face coverings unless a superior does scheduled rounds, in which then they'll put it on. I'm constantly coughing, having problems with my breathing, and I'm scared for my life knowing that I could have the virus due to the fact you can be infected without even having any symptoms. Recently, this facility has been quarantining inmates on the same housing units as general population with the rest of us, but it's unsafe due to the fact that our prison is a non-air-conditioned facility, and our cell doors are bars where the virus can widely spread just by talking through the gate. Different tactics could have been used to reduce mass incarceration during these tough times, especially high-risk inmates with chronic conditions, such as house arrest or other alternatives being an option. Me being a high-risk inmate with chronic conditions is praying that my current sentence doesn't become a death sentence due to the governor or Department of Corrections being reluctant in releasing inmates. I've been to the medical department numerous times to where staff is now telling me I'm immune to medication with no alternative. I just had a newborn son who's a little over 90 days old that I'm trying to get back home to. I'm concerned with my life, health, and the lives of other incarcerated men in this facility. We're not even certain if staff members who are entering the facility on a daily basis are still being properly tested before their shift starts or before their shift ends. It's as if nobody in the prison system is prepared for the next wave to come.
And those were words of someone who's incarcerated describing current prison conditions and fears of COVID-19 and possible deaths in Pennsylvania. And while summary executions in the streets by police are sometimes captured, when they happen on the inside, these executions go unseen, and there's little recourse for the families of those killed by prison guards on the inside. Here to talk to us about all of these issues pertaining to mass incarceration in U.S. prisons, but also to tell us about people who are killed by guards on the inside, we have with us Eva Diaz. Eva Diaz is married to Frank Diaz. They are the parents of Frankie Diaz, a prisoner at the detention center on State Road in Philadelphia, who was beaten to death on Tuesday, August 18th, 2020. We've invited Eva to tell us what she knows about what happened to her son. We're also joined by Jose Saldana. Jose Saldana is the director of Release Aging People in Prison, RAP, a grassroots organization fighting for decarceration, especially during the pandemic, but also in normal circumstances. He was released from prison in January of 2018, after spending 38 years in prison. Eva and Jose, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Good morning. Very happy to welcome both of you to the show. Ms. Diaz, I'd like to start with you. And I know that this cannot be an easy moment for you, but can you tell us what you know about what happened to your son?
Yes, on Tuesday, August.
And Ms. Diaz, can you speak a little louder so that we can hear you more clearly?
Yes. On Tuesday, August 18th, I received a call.
So you're coming, we don't have a good sound on you. I'm wondering if you maybe can move to a better place in the house.
Yes. Is it better now?
Yes, that's much better.
Okay. On Tuesday, August 18th of 2020, I received a call from the hospital when I was at work to tell me that my son, they had my son in there, that they had found my son unresponsive, and he was on life support. When I got to the hospital with my husband, the doctor informed us that my son was brain dead. As we went up to see him, when I looked back, I seen two detectives, and I asked them, why were they there? They didn't answer. They just said they were investigating. As I approached the nurse to give her my number and my information in case she needed to talk to me, she opened the chart, and I was able to see the chief complaint, which was assault. Basically, my son was beaten to death in the prison. And I have tried to get in contact with the commissioner. I have written emails. Nobody is giving me any information.
Ms. Diaz, is there anything else you know, perhaps from prisoners who might have witnessed what happened?
We have heard rumors that it could have, some people said it was inmates. Other people have said that it was the COs. But again, we have tried to get information. It's going on 1 month on Friday, the 18th, and I still haven't had any information of what happened to my son.
Can you give us a sense of who Frankie Diaz was?
Frankie Diaz, he was 30 years old. He had a heart of gold. He was not a bad person. I can't understand why they will do this to him. He never had a violent crime. I just don't understand why.
Can you give us a sense of where you're from and where Frankie grew up?
Yes, we're from, well, I'm from Puerto Rico, but I came to Philadelphia 33 years ago. So we live in North Philadelphia.
And Frankie grew up there?
Yes, Frankie was born and raised here in Philadelphia.
And when was he arrested and in detention? He was seemed to be in detention at a detention center in Philadelphia, in the greater Philadelphia area.
Yes, he was. He was arrested on December 31st, 2019.
He was waiting for trial,
which would have been his trial is Thursday. It would have been this Thursday, the 17th.
So he was awaiting trial. He was killed while awaiting trial at a detention center. I want to bring in Jose Saldana just to respond to the situation.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Johanna. I'm very sorry, Ms. Diaz, that you, as a mother, have to go through this type of loss. And I just want to add that 49 years ago, the state of New York massacred incarcerated men and women for demanding to be treated as human beings. And we are still being brutalized and murdered by the same system that annihilated hundreds of indigenous people's nations and enslaved millions of African people. This is the system that we must uproot. There's no other way of dealing with this type of brutality that is rooted in just hatred for us as human beings. We must come together, set aside all our differences like Comrade George asked us to do, and dismantle this system from the root and burn every seed that it has produced. I'm sorry to speak in such aggressive terminology, but we cannot accept reforms that do not save human beings, do not save human lives. Reforms have to lead towards decarceration and saving of lives and reuniting families and communities.
Jose, can you talk to us about your own experience? You spent 38 years in prison. Can you talk to us about your experience in prison and what you learned over the course of those many years? And can you speak a little louder?
Okay, thank you. I was incarcerated in federal prison first and then in New York. And my experience in the, especially in the state prison system, where I met some of the pioneers of New York State prison system, men like Eddie Ellis, General Joe Moe, Old Man Shasha. These men guided me toward transforming, not only transforming my life, but developing the political and social consciousness that I have. I was able to build on the consciousness that I had from the being a member of the Young Lords Party. And I've seen over the decades how men were brutalized. And if we are not murdered by brutality, racist brutality, we are murdered by the lack of adequate medical care. And this is something that has hit us real hard as incarcerated Black and Latinx men and women, because due to the lack of medical care, our longevity has been reduced to 58 years old in New York State. The average person that has died in New York State prison system is 58 years old. And this refers to Black and Latinx men and women. So this is so alarming that this in itself is a health crisis. And unfortunately, you know, during this pandemic, we've been asking, demanding that Governor Cuomo use the executive power to grant mass clemencies to the most vulnerable people in the state of New York prison system. And he has used the criteria of nonviolence to determine whether someone should or shouldn't be released. This is something that we cannot accept, you know, that our governor does not value the lives, the humanity and dignity of those who are incarcerated in this prison. He would rather have them die in prison than to be returned back to their families.
Jose, can you give us a sense of the organization you direct? What's the purpose of your organization?
Well, yes, well, the Re-Saving People in Prison campaign, commonly known as RAP, we evolved from a crisis that was created by mass incarceration. And this crisis is called, we call it death by incarceration. Men and women will be sentenced to longer terms with little opportunity to get out. In between, they were getting sick, old, and dying. And so RAP evolved to correct this crisis created by mass incarceration and ultimately to end mass incarceration through a decarceration relief process. And we propose and advocate for moderate transformation in the form of legislative initiatives. Two bills that both of them in combination with transforming the New York State Parole Board would lead towards significant decarceration and ultimately to abolition of the entire prison system. And the Elder Parole Bill, the Elder Parole Bill, which provides that if a person is 55 years old and has served 15 years, they will automatically be entitled for parole release consideration. We do not exclude anyone based on their crime of conviction or the length of sentence. This bill, if it is passed, would actually neutralize such sentences as life without parole and such virtual death sentences as 50 years to life, 75 years to life, because the person would automatically appear before the parole board at 55 and perhaps serve 50 years. And the second bill transformed the entire relief process of New York State parole board. They can no longer use the nature of the offense that in most cases happened decades ago as a basis for denying parole. They will have to make a determination as to whether a person is a risk to public safety by current circumstances, not the crime. The risk to public safety cannot be mitigated by parole supervision. That means if a person has received a dirty urine or possession of drugs, now this may be determined to pose a risk, but it can be mitigated by parole supervision, so they cannot use that as a justification for releasing. This actually creates a presumption of release at the first parole board hearing. And the other initiative we advocate for is to transform the entire New York State Parole Board. 19 commissioners are allowed by law to serve on the board. We demand that every single commissioner, all 19 commissioners, believe in redemption and value human transformation. If they do not believe that a human being can transform their life, they cannot be a parole commissioner. And obviously, this would prevent the parole board from being dominated from people with law enforcement background who, by nature of their profession, do not believe that we can transform our lives.
Thank you, Jose, for that overview. We know that over the course of the last 50 years, 40 years, folks who've been imprisoned have been over-sentenced. And this is an attempt through policy to turn that around. And if ever there were a moment to decarcerate and to consider these proposals, this would be the moment. When there's a pandemic that is potentially sentencing so many people in prison right now to death. I want to go back to Mrs. Diaz. Mrs. Diaz, you've been embattled with the prison system for the last month or so. Can you give us a sense of what you've attempted to do, but also what you've learned about the system of prisons and incarceration?
Yes. For the past month, like you said, we've been battling with the system, with the prison system. We have the family and some close friends have been on state road on a peaceful protest at least four times. I have called the commissioner. I went to the district attorney's office last Wednesday. I stood in front of their door looking to talk to somebody for some help, for some answers. Nobody acknowledged. They didn't even invite me to come in. I have written emails to Tumor Alexander, which is the director of the business. I forget the name of the title, but he's somebody that's in charge of the prisons that oversees the commissioner. No response. I called his private lawyer. He claimed he didn't even know that my son was murder. It's going on a month. I have learned through this process the prison system really does not care about human life. They don't care about the family. They don't care about our feelings. They don't care at all.
How has
the inmates are just a number. That's all they are.
How has this experience transformed your understanding of the prison system?
Uh, I've never been incarcerated. But I thought, you know, that they would, the COs and the inmates were, you know, safe in there. Well, I've learned different. That's not a safe place for anybody to be in. They just don't care.
Can you tell us what your demands are?
I'm demanding, number one, justice for my son and answers for the family. I am a mother. I need to know what happened. Bad enough, I don't have my son. And for me to wonder every single day from the minute I open my eyes to the minute I can't close them, what happened? Why? Who did it? There's no answers. It's horrible not to have your son and not know what happened or even why would they do that. I will not stop until I get justice for my son and answers. I deserve that. We, the family, deserve answers. I'm sorry, but it's just, it's hard. I'm in constant pain, but all day long.
Mrs. Diaz, we are here to amplify your story and your son's story and to let the world know that your son was your son, a human being whose life was taken at age 30 by the state. And we pledge to walk with you in this battle. Are you targeting a specific official? For example, DA Larry Krasner.
Yes. Yes, I would love to have a sit down with him and talk to him about this situation. But of course, they won't even let you in the door because I went to his office on Wednesday.
And got no response?
No response from anybody.
Jose, can we turn to you again on the issue of the pandemic? Why do you think governors across the country, not only here in New York State, have resisted releasing aging people in prison who stand to die of COVID-19 if they're infected?
Well, let me first say that, you know, think about the governor in New York State. Governor Cuomo, a former prosecutor, you know, he had a whole career as a prosecutor incarcerating Black and Latinx people, and now we're demanding that he release them. Obviously, he hasn't met our demands. He's thinking like a prosecutor, and he's probably has aspirations of running for the presidency in the future. But the bottom line is that governors across the state, whether it doesn't really matter what party they belong to, but governors across the state, their decision-making process is also rooted in racism. They will not, they will not, they, they, just won't value the humanity of incarcerated Black and Latinx people. It's just not in them to do that because they are so vested in this system. And because all science, as well as social science, points in one direction that, in reference to the elder people that are incarcerated, and I speak for those who have been incarcerated for 3 and 4 decades, who are in their 70s now, the most vulnerable people, you would think that not only are they the most vulnerable ones, but they are the least likely to ever return to prison, and they are an asset to their communities once they are released. You would think that they are the safe bet to be released. But like I said, it's that ideology of racism that determines the decision-making process on who should be released and who should die in prison. And this just runs across the country. That's why we have to unite, create this mass-based national movement to uproot this system. It's not going to go away on its own. And this goes to the murder of Ms. Diaz's son. There's no transparency with them there because they are culpable. They are responsible for the murder of her son. And it, whether it's by death, by lack of medical care, death by a pandemic, that they do not help us take the proper preventive measures, or death by brutality, it all boils down to the same system that just not only does it marginalize our community, but it keeps us powerless to do anything about it. But we're not powerless. We can definitely uproot this system if we come together.
I'm Johanna Fernandez, and I'm speaking to Jose Saldana, the director of Release Aging People in Prison, and Ms. Eva Diaz, whose son, Frankie Diaz, a prisoner at the detention center on State Road in Philadelphia, was beaten to death on Tuesday, August 18th. I'd like to take your calls. We've got time for a few calls. The number to call is 212-209-2877. Once again, call us. 212-209-2877. And, you know, as I was listening to both of you, the theme is clear, as I outlined by you, Jose, it's and Mrs. Diaz, it's a heartless system that has targeted poor people of color, Black Americans and Latinos, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Mexicans are a growing population in the prisons, as are Black women. And you're sentenced to death. Right now, it's a system of punishment that targets Black and Latinos structurally, and then has no regard for life. And the question is, how do we turn this around? Call us, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. So what do we do? We need to build a mass movement. If people want to get involved, how can they support you, Mrs. Diaz? And I'd like to take a response from Jose.
Yes. I have Bob Wittenick, I'm sorry. He has been helping me. We have created a Facebook page, which is hashtag #JusticeNumber4FrankieDiaz Committee. And Bob's number is 908-881-5275. If they want to join in our committee for Justice for Frankie, they can reach out either through Facebook or through him. and get more information from there.
Okay, and there's a demonstration on Thursday in Philadelphia. We're going to take a call. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello, my name is Stanley, calling from Long Island.
Welcome, Stanley.
Hello, hello. For understanding, I was taught that certain prisons that are bought by state or certain state prisons that are bought that are from private organizations, that the deal is that once they buy them, that they have to keep 90% capacity full. And I think this is a lot of the reasons why people don't get released who should get released.
Stanley from Long Island or Staten Island?
Long Island.
Long Island. Thank you so very much for your comment. Absolutely. The privatization of prisons is a problem. Thank you so very much for calling. Jose Saldana, would you like to respond to this?
Yes, in New York State, there are no private prisons, not privately owned. You know, they're all owned by the state, which is basically the same thing. But just the notion of a private prison, it just brings back a private plantation. That's exactly what it would be. But let me just say that prison is prison. There are no good prisons. And the only purpose that prison serves is to create the need for more prisons.
We have another caller. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Yes. Greetings to the beloved family. This is my aunt calling always from the cave. This is such a serious problem, and the brother was so right when he said we're not powerless. So I think one of the things that we need to do is look at this, and it's about to get a lot worse. Per the report earlier from Johanna regarding Michael Caputo accusing the people who are not the violent ones like the white supremacists, but the so-called left. I think one of the things we also have to look at is the lack of cohesiveness and true community. There's a root to the fact that we've become so powerless in this society. And my deep condolences in my heart to you, sister. There will be some good result to this.
Thank you so very much, Mayat. We have two more callers. Caller, you're on the line. Your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Ida from the Bronx.
Ida, welcome.
Greetings. I'd like to give strength and love to the mother who lost her son to more police brutality and more brutality of the state. My conclusions right now from everything that we're seeing, it seems as if we have to make a decision. We have to either find a way to remove their power over us, or we have to actually have people in place that we're going to put there, vote for them to be there, and have them at the tables as liaisons for us to remove all these people that have current authority over our lives. I mean, it's not a false authority because our people are being killed. It's not a false manner that they come at us and target us. It's real. So it's kind of up to us to continue, like you say, to organize and to create a mass movement. But I don't see many people out there in their boardrooms, in their companies, or at their homes telling them that you can't leave this house because we're firing you. Our taxes are the ones that pay your bills. We no longer want you or need you here. We have someone else that we are putting in place. We have to be the managers that our dollar says that we are, I feel like.
Thank you so much for this platform. Thank you very much, Ida, for calling us from the Bronx. And we're going to take one final caller. Caller, please keep it short because we've got little time. Your name and where you're calling from.
Alec from the Bronx, yeah. just such a truthful and real conversation. At the base of it all, obviously, we all know it's racism. And it's such a dysfunctional system. This whole system is so it's very sick. One of the reasons that people are not let out is because, you know, there's a social responsibility that people come out. For example, you got to have Medicare health services. People will become homeless. It's such a dysfunctional system. And if there's a will, and there is a will, actually, by many people out there, including myself, to change the system, it will be changed. So,
Alex,
yes.
Thank you so very much. We're going to have to give it to our guests. I just want to say a few things before we do so. Mrs. Eva Diaz, please tell us where the demonstration will be and when. Laura Whitehorn is someone who's a former political prisoner and activist from fierce activists and revolutionary from the 1960s. Has instructed me on prisons and the police, and these are tools of the state whose purpose is to keep the people at the bottom of society in their place, especially in an increasingly unequal society. And part of what Alex and others, Ida, are suggesting is that we need to figure out what is the lever that we need to pull in society that can force it to change. Mrs. Diaz, please tell us quickly where the demonstration will be on Thursday.
This Thursday, we're going to be marching from 13th and Filbert in Philadelphia. It's the courthouse. We will be taking our march to 14th and JFK to Toomer's Alexander's. And then coming down to the DA's office, which is maybe a block and a half away from there.
Okay, so this Thursday at what time?
10 o'clock in the morning. 10 o'clock in the morning.
This Thursday at 10 o'clock at the courthouse where?
On 13th and Filbert.
On 13th. 13th and Filbert Center City, Philadelphia. 10 a.m. Yes. Thursday, Filbert and 13th. Jose Saldana, how can we contact RAP?
Yes, thank you for asking that. Just visit our website, RAP's website, that's rappcampaign.com. You'll get all the information you need. Our next event, we meet virtually now. Our membership meeting, monthly membership meetings are virtual, but we do have some in-person events going on, especially during this month that commemorates Attica Uprising.
Thank you so very much, both of you, for the work that you're doing. Mrs. Diaz, our condolences to you and our pledge to continue to amplify your son's voice. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the end of our show for today. You've been listening to non-commercial listener-funded community radio, WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. This show is produced by Ajamu Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, Davin Smith, Andrea Hidalgo, and L. Moulton Boken. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We leave you with the song Dime by Jose Luis Perales. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for tuning in. A new day. See you on Thursday.
Porque los niños maltratados, porque los viejos olvidados, porque los sueños prohibidos. Dime. Dímelo, Dios, quiero saber. Dime por qué te niegas a escucharme.